And this one is continuing the theme of work that we've had threaded throughout the afternoon here, and that is we have work to do. Now, we value the lived experience of blind people and the wisdom that we bring and we get from our members in this organization. And as we have created new programs, especially our youth programs, that has infused a new level of understanding into our organization, because we now have multiple generations, really, of young people who have grown up in Federation programs. And this afternoon, we have one of those individuals. She has been participating in Federation programs since 2006, when she attended our Rocket On Science Academy. And she says she has never looked back. She also has been a major factor in providing leadership in various parts of the Federation. And she's affecting change in corporate America, where she brings her experience and understanding with blindness to corporate America. But because she's working in corporate America, we benefit from that as well, because she brings her observations, her learning from corporate America back to this movement to make it better, to make our community stronger and more effective in the work that we do in outreach to entities in corporate America. So here to provide her perspective from both her experience growing up in the organized blind movement, but with corporate America, is the lead disability inclusion consultant for Cisco Systems and a longtime member and leader in the National Federation of the Blind. Here's Mary Fernandez.
Work. I'm so happy I got my song, y'all. I was like, President Rick Ovono, I need Rihanna in my life. Good afternoon, fellow Federationists. I want to say thank you. Thank you for this great honor. I grew up in this organization, and this is legit the most high-pressure speech I've ever delivered. At Cisco, I've been working for the last year in developing an accessibility strategy as we look into leaning into a purpose of powering an inclusive future for all. And that includes disabled people. And so I am very excited today that that strategy work is mostly complete, and I'm really looking forward to perhaps seeing some of our executives join us in the NFB next year to tell us about how we'll continue to enable collaboration for all, including the blind. All right, I have a lot, I have a long speech. When I was a little girl, my mom used to tell me to eat your books. This was her way of telling me that literacy and education would be the key to my future. Yesterday's agenda featured brilliant women like Susan Mazarui and Eve Hill and Carla Gilbride, and every one of them said we were stubborn children. And so today I want to say to you, hi, it's me, I'm the stubborn one, it's me. And so as a stubborn child, I like to say no. I will not read. Thankfully, my mother is a literal force of nature. So one day, after throwing a tantrum, my mother threw me in my bedroom with a Braille book and said, child, you will read. And I threw a tantrum. I screamed, I cried, I threw myself on the floor, but there was nothing but silence from the outside. Finally, in an act of absolute and utter 7-year-old desperation, I slowly and tentatively ran my fingers over the title, Freckle Juice by Judy Blume. And then I did the unthinkable. I painstakingly and ever so slowly opened to the first page. And then I realized there was a bunch of copyright stuff on the first page, and I was like, what the heck? Like, when are they gonna get to it? Because, like, intellectual property is not a real thing for a 7-year-old. And finally, it began. Line up, boys and girls, Miss Kelly said. Time to go home now. I was hooked. I was hooked on books. I was hooked in literacy. And most of all, I was hooked on Braille. This stubborn child learned and continues to learn that my mommy is always right. So thank you, mommy. And in that moment, she couldn't have been more right. Literacy was my key to education, and my educational career taught me that stories move me, that curiosity drives me, but that human connection feeds me. She knew the importance of Braille literacy for her blind child, and she would always say that if you can read, you can do anything. Hence, reading Braille made it possible for me to gain that well-rounded education. And for me, education was always the puzzle piece, with the first puzzle piece for that thing that is so hard for disabled folks, which is finding and keeping a job. I acknowledge that to say that education leads directly to a job is, and most importantly, a fulfilling career, is an oversimplification. I actually would argue that the skills necessary for being successful in the job market really start at home. And those skills are supposed to be reinforced in the school system. And then they're supposed to be cultivated and nurtured as we become adults and are able to make more substantive decisions around our careers. But when you introduce blindness to the equation, the oppressive force of ableism tends to break those natural links. Today, I want to answer 3 questions around unemployment. 1, why is the unemployment gap still so significant? What could I do as an individual to be more successful in the job market? And what can employees do to more meaningfully move the needle? So let's look at the statistics. According to the U.S. Bureau of Statistics in 2022, the unemployment rate of disabled people was over 9% versus 3.4% and dropping for non-disabled people. This means that disabled people are 3 times unemployed versus non-disabled people. The statistics go on, and you can break them any way you want. But the bottom line is that disabled people are disproportionately unemployed and underemployed. And this is particularly true when you have other marginalized identity. It is one thing to hear these numbers. They almost don't connect with us, but it's another thing to live it. When I graduated as a senior from Emory University, I had a 3.8 GPA. I had done, thank you. That was a long time ago. And I remember the first semester of my senior year, I applied to an average of 5 jobs a day. And that sinking feeling when every single letter came back saying, thanks, but no thanks. Dear sir or madam, thanks, but no thanks. I will also never forget that after 5 years of work experience as a paralegal at Brown, Goldstein & Levy, shout out to Brown, Goldstein & Levy, and helping stand up the EDGE program in New Jersey, shout out to New Jersey, I was back on the job market, and as I saw something more permanent, I was happy to do something part-time. And so I applied to be a 6th grade English tutor, which was a remote position. And y'all, I am happy to say that I was as smart as a sixth grader because I passed the test, I aced the application, and I got a call saying, hey, you got the job. So I was like, great, awesome, thank you. So two things. One, I'd love to test out the accessibility of the collaborative software you use. And two, I'd love to get those materials in electronic format so I can be successful. And there was a long silence. And 10 minutes later, I got a call back saying that the position was mysteriously no longer available. To see a sixth grade part-time English tutor. Most of us in this room had have that struggle with ourselves, whether or not to disclose our disability after getting a job offer, while knowing that the choice offers no assurance of employment at the end of the process. Now, more than any other time in history, we have unparalleled access to technology. We have laws that are supposed to protect us, and we have commitments from companies around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and statements that say we really do want you here. And yet, digital tools we need to do our jobs every single day remain inaccessible. Discrimination cases take years to resolve, and companies with bold DEI commitment statements published in their career pages seem to miss and forget that accommodations and accessibility are part of inclusion and equity. At the heart of all of this, there's only one answer, and that is oppression. There are four part types and parts to oppression. They're ideological, institutional, interpersonal, internalized. And these four forms of oppression work together to shape a narrative that truly impacts every aspect of our life. I don't have the time to go into that today, but President Riccomono, a whole presentation on oppression would be a great addition to next year's agenda. So if you're interested, give me a call. I have suggestions. One important aspect of oppression I do want to share is internalized oppression or ableism. This is the most uncomfortable form to oppression to acknowledge because it really makes us listen to that voice that says you are not enough. If you ask for accommodation, you're not as good an employee. If you ask for help as a blind person, you're not a good enough person. And all of these voices really feed on each other and on the other forms of oppression because they make us in some form doubt our worth. And we know that as an organization, we reject this. And one of the most effective ways of countering internalized oppression is through community and collective action. It is the counter narrative we provide for each other of strength, a narrative of resilience, and that control of our future. It is training, advocacy, and the refusal to settle for second-class citizenship that is core to our organization. In the face of oppression, what can one individual do to break down those barriers? How can we carry on when systems are supposed to support us but yet are broken? The good news is that the NFP has always been a group made up of former stubborn children and has been dismantling oppression for over 80 years. And every one of us in this room has benefited from that. When there were no useful orientation and mobility training, we invented it. And then we refined it. And then we taught it to each other. If they will not teach our children well Braille, we will teach them ourselves. And at the same time, we will fight until they get that equal access in school. And as an individual, I found the most value in community. The community I have found here has been one of the most important and integral parts of my success. You see, when I arrived to the United States from Colombia, I was almost 8 years old. I was two when my mom left Colombia at the age of 26. She didn't know English. She didn't know where she was going to go. And yet she took a plane to JFK and landed in New York. After working here for a year, she got a call that I was diagnosed with a glaucoma, and it would simply be a matter of time until I was fully blind. My mother used the pain of her daughter during this pivotal moment and turned it into fuel to remain laser focused on bringing me and my brother to the U.S. She knew then that it would be the only chance at a fulfilling life. So I came here an awkward and stubborn child. I had no social skills, had never attended school, and I don't think I even really understood what blindness was. All I knew is that when my O&M instructor put a short and stubby stick in my hand and told me I had to carry it around, I promptly dropped it on the floor. Though the uphill battle to get me to read was fairly quickly won, the battle to have me use a cane proved a lot harder. You see, I had deeply internalized beliefs about blindness and disability, and a cane was a visible sign of my difference. And though by the time I was in high school, I used it every day, I still felt like an outcast. No matter what I did, I was either invisible to others or felt like the most conspicuous person in the room. It wasn't until I was 14 that my feelings about myself began to shift, and that's because I became part of the LEAD program in New Jersey for blind and low vision students and met the likes of Sherlock Washington, and one of the mentors that had the most impact in my life, Joe Ruffalo. Yay. Joe gave me my first real lesson in advocacy. We were at the National Center, and I really wanted to do this Rocket On program I had heard about. And he's like, there's Mr. Riccobono. He's the man in charge. Go talk to him. And so I did, and he did, and now the rest is history. Here I am. Finding community equates to finding belonging. We know that blind people are not a monolith, but at the same time, we have a shared lived experience that we all understand, and we understand the false narratives around blindness. With the NFB, I found my little tribe, and that tribe has carried me through the hardest parts of my life. So all of us, in this employment journey, listen, it's hard. It's brutal, it's awful, it's demoralizing. But it is a lot harder when you have to do it alone. It is harder when we have no one to turn to tell them how uncomfortable it was when the interview turned from our qualifications to a disability training. I encourage all of you to find and stay in this community. And not everybody in this room is your cup of tea, and that's okay. But some of us are. And so find us and stay with us. Participating in the Federation sparked a passion and my gift for advocacy. As a little girl, y'all, I was always looking for the injustice to right. And when I came to the NFB, and understood why I felt like an outcast, and that Braille was denied to children that me, and that babies were taken away from their parents because their parents were blind, I said, this is it. This is what I have to fight for every day. The NFB has also sharpened my leadership skills. I delivered my first speech at the NFB NJ convention when I was 14. I led affiliate student divisions, and those leadership skills quickly transferred outside the NFB. I became involved in after-school programs and clubs and really dove headlong into understanding what leadership meant. And I learned that leadership does not spring from positional power, but rather from the actions we take to influence change. And that is something each and every one of us can do, no matter where we are and where we sit. As I have gotten older, I identified the values that carry me everywhere, values that were instilled by my mother, nurtured by the Federation, and implemented by me. I value integrity, honesty, hard work, collaboration, and authenticity. I conduct myself with courage, including the courage to speak truth to power, which is something I learned in this organization. I say all this to bring several things to the forefront. First, instilling confidence, reliability, and resilience starts at home. Letting our children take risks, letting them know that, yes, they are wonderful and have gifts, not because they're blind, because they have very specific gifts and talents. All of these contribute to shaping future employees and future leaders. Second, that in the face of oppression, we as a collective are the best at developing each other's gifts and talents. We provide a space where we support each other, but also constantly challenge each other to grow. And when the world won't provide, we fill in the opportunity gaps to ensure that our youth have a full and well-rounded set of life experiences. Are we perfect? No. Being disabled does not mean we do not hold ableist beliefs. We must always work to dismantle them. Even as we push each other, we must find ways to uplift each other and not fall into the trap of oppressing each other. We know that there isn't one right way to do blindness, and we must provide space for that. We know that blindness is often accompanied by other disabilities, and we must cultivate spaces where those of us with multiple disabilities can thrive. As I think about employment and the collective movement, I keep coming back to the evolution of our own organizations. Today we're having conversations about our identities taken together and how they form an intersection inseparable from how we experience the world. When I started in the NFB, I embraced this idea that blindness was just a characteristic, like my hair. And y'all have gorgeous curly hair. But as I've grown into my work and dived into my identities, I actually think that disability is far more than that. My disability is actually part of my identity. You see, if I had the same hair in 20/20 vision, I probably would have had equitable access to my educational instructional materials in graduate school. However, because of my disability, I did not. And this is also impacted by my other identities, such as my gender, my skin color, my language. I no longer believe that asking for equal access is actually enough. Rather, in my work, I advocate for equitable access. That is to provide... I'm glad you like that. That is to provide the tools and resources that individuals need to be successful. Equality is providing stairs for everyone. Equity is providing stairs, elevator, escalators, and ramps in equally convenient places so that people can choose their path. And because equity is so much more complex, that means that there isn't a simple solution. In his speech, The Nature of Independence, Dr. Jernigan wrote, unless you make advances, I'm getting there. because I want to do it justice. Unless you make advances over what we have done, you will, in a very real sense, fail to keep the faith with those who have gone before you and those who follow. And I challenge us all to stay on this path of seeking not just equality, but equity. Because if freedom is the right to choose, then equity is the path to that freedom. Employers, thank you. Employers, I have some words for you. Any employers in the room? Woo, okay. And there are three best practices I want to leave you with. First, design with us, not for us. Oftentimes, employers ask me, oh my God, so what can disabled people do? And how do I hire them? And where are they? And then programs are launched with names that include words like differently abled and special talents and uniquely gifted. I dare say that everybody in this room is differently abled, but not everybody in this room is blind. These are seldom designed with disabled people in mind, but rather for disabled people. And here's the good news. You are here with us, so you're already in the room where it happens. And so and so engage with us to understand the value that we bring. And yes, it is going to be messy and difficult, but when we work with each other, we create talent-based strategies which truly open up opportunity. Second, let's stop performative hiring. A lot of times, I attended a conference last year where most of the Fortune 100 turns up, and they had this competition of who was going to hire the most disabled people. And so I went to the job fair. I'm like, let me see what's up. And I went to the company that was leading in numbers, and I told them about my experience, like, oh, well, we don't really have anything for you. We're only looking for entry-level internships. So being a curious soul, I walked around, and I said, hey, do you have anything for me? And they were like, nope. Friends, it is not enough to hire at entry level. First, when you do recruit and hire disabled talent at entry level, ask yourselves, what am I doing to develop this talent into true leaders? How am I removing the barriers? And also, disabled talent is far from just being entry-level talent. We need to really shift the ways we think about what executive leadership looks like, because executive leadership is blind, is deaf, is disabled, is autistic, is dyslexic. Do not put it on us to be good enough to break your glass ceiling. It is your job to take off your own roof. If you do these two things, design with us and critically assess and revamp your recruitment strategies, then you start slowly to reach for the higher fruit. That stretch will get you to brush the tips of the branches of belonging. Belonging is a sense that each of us is fundamentally valued and our uniqueness is treasured. And I will tell you right now, there is only one week in the year I feel like I truly belong, and it is in this convention. So all of us in this room, my ask is to not only give back, but to always pay it forward. Mentoring, advocating, connecting, these are all ways of paying it forward. So I'll leave you with this question. What will you do to pay it forward? In that spirit, I want to pay it forward today. For the stubborn child who refused to accept society's narrative about her blindness. For every person in this room who is just finding their community. And for every parent who fights every day for their child's future without limits. I'm going to say this in Spanish first, and then I will translate it. En honor de la mujer que tuvo el más impacto en mi vida, yo voy a donar $3,300 a la Federación Nacional de los Ciegos, porque yo sé que no hay ninguna otra organización que invierte en la educación de los jóvenes ciegos como la Federación. I love that half the room understood that. In honor of the woman who raised me to be courageous, fearless, authentic, and a strong advocate, I am now pledging wait a second. Let me not say the wrong number now. $3,300 to the NFB in honor of Clara Roman, my mother. That's $100 from every year because I'm not an actual baller. So, you know, this what we can do right now. I trust no other organization will put this to better youth, to educating our youth, to pushing the boundaries of what we've been told is possible. Education has been the touchstone of my success. My mother, the unwavering support. And the NFB, the community that has helped me and on whose shoulders I stand.